This podcast is brought to you by Northern Motor Group. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
Nation Radio, and you're listening to If You Know Your History. I'm Ian Sison, and I'm with Paul Mavroudis. How are you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You have a good week?
It was all right.
Yeah. Working for the election?
Yeah, working for the Australian Electoral Commission as a temp worker.
Yes.
Guarding the ballot box.
Yep.
Minding the queue.
Yep.
Occasionally issuing a vote.
Good. It's
translating.
It's all part of democracy, isn't it?
And isn't democracy wonderful?
It is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing.
It's a good thing we don't have it here.
Well, I spent, while you were busy working for the Australian people, I spent a week in Hervey Bay in Queensland.
Any Australian people there?
All Aussies, mate.
Stinky die?
Stinky die, yeah. Most of them are Victorians.
That's as stinky die as you can get.
Both taxis I took were driven by Victorians.
Did they have the footy on the radio?
Love the footy. Love me footy.
Who doesn't love me footy?
I was asked which team I followed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as I was staying in Hervey Bay last week, and unfortunately we had to miss the show because of that, I thought in the little spare time that I had, I'd search Trove for some history of the game in that region. And it strikes me that there isn't much of a deep history of the game in Hervey Bay. And even though there's a thriving competition now and it's very popular at the junior level, it's got no deep history. The earliest article I could find was from 1951, and that was like an exhibition game being played there. But what was really interesting was that the game in the surrounding district of Hervey Bay, what you might call Wide Bay, or the Fraser Coast, it was an entirely different matter.
Before we go any further, can you explain the geography of Queensland? Where is Hervey Bay in relation to everything else?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Hervey Bay is about 3 hours drive north of Brisbane. Mm. It's on the coast. It's protected from all of the weather by Fraser Island, which is a massive sand island.
Is it the one with all the dingoes?
Yeah, dingoes. And Hervey Bay is a remarkable place because it never gets serious weather. It never gets, there can be storms all around it.
And is that why all the old people are there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
That's why my mum and dad are there.
Mm.
Yeah. So there wasn't much to note, but what I did notice that in Maryborough there's a strong competition, Maryborough, Queensland, which is about 20 miles inland from Hervey Bay, and townships around, the two townships called Howard and Torben Lee have this phenomenal history. Torben Lee goes back to 1894 and Howard soccer goes back to 1888.
So what kind of towns are these? I mean, what are they doing out there?
Well, they used to be mining towns. And this is like an echo through the ages of soccer history, isn't it? It was a mining town.
It was a mining town.
Yeah, and now it's there's not much soccer played there now, and these are rump towns. They're not quite ghost towns, and they're probably building a little bit because the whole area of Hervey Bay is becoming like a conurbation almost, a rural conurbation full of people on the dole. It's interesting. Anyway. So Howard was a phenomenally powerful team at different stages. It did the disappearing act in the very early 1900s, but in 1888 it started, and 10 years later it was the strongest team, just about the strongest team in southeast Queensland. It beat the Brisbane team in 1898. And remember, this is a tiny little town. It beat the Brisbane team, and it used to play against the Bushrats, the Dinmore Bushrats, and be very competitive against that team when it was a very strong team in the Ipswich region. And they beat Brisbane 2-0, and that gave them the right to play New South Wales at the Brisbane Cricket Ground. Can you imagine? So this country team, probably about the size of Shepparton at the time, no, even smaller.
Mm.
Maybe Ararat,
wow,
or Stawell.
Yes.
That we're talking a town that big, beat Melbourne and then got to Melbourne to play on the MCG to play against New South Wales. That's the sort of parallel story, and it's an absurd story, isn't it?
Looks like something out of Mr. Clean Sheets.
Yeah. It is.
That's a bit of an in-joke.
Yeah. And they played against New South Wales and they were hammered 9-0, as you'd expect. But the Howard team had a couple of Queensland representative players in it, the Bullock brothers. That'd be right.
So is it sort of like an equivalent of like a Joe Adger, perhaps, in New South Wales?
I think so. I think that's a good comparison. So Joe Adger, for those of you who don't know, is a very strong team that's based in a shale mining town. And they beat...
That's in New South Wales, isn't it?
Yeah, in New South Wales. And one year they beat both the New South Wales team and the Victorian team. Although I think the Victorian team was still getting over the sheer terror of having to descend down the mountain path into Joe Adger, which was incredibly steep. But so you've got these teams in these little mining places all around Australia that are incredibly strong.
So this almost harks back, in a sense, perhaps, I mean, I'm spitballing here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the miners, probably a lot of them would have been Scottish or Northern English.
Yep.
And they would have been perfectly used to being, you know, people from very small towns playing football.
Yeah.
So playing against more populous cities, towns, whatever, would have had no fear for them.
No. That they wouldn't have had any fear. These were strong teams and strong, very self-confident teams, and probably played the game in a kind of interesting spirit that was very different from the way the game's probably played today.
And we'll discuss that a bit later as well.
Yes, we will.
But what I would say, though, is that even though it's very strong at times in these towns, like Joe Adger, like Howard, et cetera, yeah. The fact that they're linked to towns which are so dependent on mining and they're so small means that soccer's footing is...
Yeah. It's loose.
It's very loose.
And the game wanes and it gets resurrected and it wanes and gets resurrected, and which is the story we know for most of Australia.
And in some ways that you could make that it's sort of analogous to waves of migration as well.
But yeah.
I mean, obviously there's migration of the actual Englishmen and Scots and so forth going there. But as it wanes in terms of industry, that's the same kind of story in terms of what's waned in terms of waves of migration in terms of ethnicity.
Yeah.
And as Roy Hayes' argument is, it's only in recent times that Australian soccer no longer depends on ethnicity or migration of any sort to sustain itself. It's actually got...
If it's indeed sustaining itself.
Well, as a participation sport, it is.
It is.
It now has a critical mass.
Yeah.
And it's a domestic, homegrown, nativist
group. I think that a lot of kids playing soccer in Australia throughout the ages, from the 20s on, have been, if you like, locals and not migrants.
Yes.
I think it's a very strong game historically
yes.
for local kids. And I don't like to use that term local, but I'm making a distinction between local and migrant.
Yeah, well, but you have to refer then to nativist sentiments as well.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what comes up in the sort of the district versus the ethnic arguments right throughout Australian soccer history. I mean, we've gone a bit off the beaten path here with the Howard situation, but... these are arguments which are really important. I mean, why does soccer fall away in certain communities? And it's for different things at different times.
Yeah.
But in a lot of these cases, we're talking about mining towns. Yeah. Well, as long as there's a mine, yes, there's going to be people there and whatever. But when the industry leaves...
Mm. But I think the important thing to also note is that in Queensland around this stage, you know, soccer wanes, waxes and wanes. So does Australian rules. And Australian rules wanes and doesn't come back in the way that soccer does, which is an interesting thing. Because, you know, Australian rules was arguably quite strong in Queensland in the 80s. And then it's...
In the 1880s.
Yeah, in the 1880s, but gets incredibly weak to the point of extinction in the early 1900s.
And that's, that's something that happens then all over New Zealand as well, because Australian rules during the Great Depression or the 1890s, a lot of Victorians moved to New Zealand and they set up Australian rules leagues. And for a time, it looks like there's a foothold of sorts for Australian rules football in New Zealand. But then as soon as the migration pattern stops, it just collapses very quickly and there's no like legacy there.
Do you know that when I was in New Zealand in 1980, there was a competition in Auckland? And it used to make the papers. There's
nothing else going in Auckland at the time.
Australian rules competition. It was quite interesting, and some Australian there playing Australian rules found out that I was Australian and asked me if I wanted to play. And that was a very ironic sort of question.
Yeah. So what did you end up playing there?
I played soccer. I played for a team called Bream Bay.
Tell us about the goal you scored.
From inside my own half, inside the centre circle. Mm. That was magnificent.
Is that recorded anywhere in history?
No, it's
just on this show.
Just on this show. Yeah, so I was playing centre back as I usually did, and I just went whack because the coach had said though that the keeper's got his sun in his eyes, so pepper him, and so I did.
That's not pepper. That's just throwing the whole the tree at him.
Anyway, I scored. I couldn't believe it. He just. We can do that. He was going like that, trying to catch it, and I'm waving my hands above my head. No, he didn't catch it. So anyway, why are we talking about this?
Because we're talking about history.
Yeah, okay.
We're talking about New Zealand, and we backtracked for there from Australian rules, and we're talking about Queensland waning.
Let me go, because I don't have much more to say about the Queensland thing, but this was a phase in Queensland history. It's like some sort of anti-centralist political fantasy. In Queensland soccer, where the team was made up from players around the state. So you had a couple of Brisbane players, but you had Ipswich players, Howard players, two of them. You had Rockhampton players, Charters Towers and Mount Morgan. And all of these towns are represented. And what is the common thread in these towns?
What is it?
Apart from Brisbane, the common thread is mining, both kinds.
In Rockhampton as well?
Yep. Wow. Well, the Lakes Creek, Mount Morgan, and places like that. And it makes you realise that everywhere there's a mine, there's a soccer competition. There's a soccer team playing,
and that tells you a lot about the people who have arrived there to do the mining.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And so this is the thing we learn from this story, that there are periodically immensely strong teams all around Australia, and you'll often find nearby a coal mine or even a hard rock mine.
And maybe the kind of mining is also important here because, okay, they find gold in Kalgoorlie and all these kinds of things, and they go, but when the depression happens in Victoria and the southern states especially, the Victorians go west, but they're looking for gold.
Yeah, but a lot of coal miners went west as well because they had mining experience. They didn't have hard rock experience, but some experience was better than none.
Yeah.
And so they did.
But there might be an interesting thing to sort of follow through. I mean, maybe perhaps the kind of mining actually had an influence about where soccer took hold as well.
Mm.
Because if gold mining attracts a certain demographic of people, maybe more Victorians than, say, people from England or Scotland, maybe that's one of the reasons why, say, soccer doesn't quite take hold in these small towns in Western Australia as much as it does in Queensland.
Or maybe in Ballarat as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, towns like that where there is a gold. There's a cultural ideology attached to gold that might not be soccer positive, whereas there's a cultural ideology attached to coal, which means that soccer is going to be thereabouts.
I mean, gold attracts all sorts of people, especially people who've never mined before.
Yeah.
They're just trying to get their wealth, whereas coal mining is a generations-old industry. So people have done it back home in England, in Scotland, or in northern France or wherever.
Yeah.
And they come here and they end up doing the same thing.
Yep.
Regardless of, and then they just take their cultural habits with them.
Yep.
It might be cricket, it might be soccer, it might be rugby league in a lot of cases.
Yep. Well, I mean, we're going to talk soon about a distinction between soccer and rugby league in New South Wales, but let's hold that off for a while. But that's probably my trip to Queensland. The research I did on my trip to Queensland, I had a great sort of interchange with Peter Eady and Gary McKenzie, as you'd expect, and we were keeping each other on our toes and feeding more information left, right and centre. And Gary McKenzie's also found some amazing stuff on Quilp. We'll have to talk about Quilp and Bondi Neil down the track sometime.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had a really interesting kind of little week off. I was just saying green paper here, white paper here.
Yeah. Speaking of green and white, no, that's Western United.
They're green and black.
Yeah, I know, but I was trying to guess.
As I said in actual tweet, which they end up stealing, black for the Princes Freeway, which connects the two regions, and green for the median strip.
Well, I was looking for a segue into talking about MacArthur, but they're sort of ochre, aren't they? Ochre, black and white.
I haven't really paid attention.
Yeah, well, you should have.
Why?
Because there's an amazing mistake made.
Oh, okay.
An amazing mistake made in their presentation.
And who's made the mistake?
Well, Simon Hill read the mistake, but I'm sure he didn't do the research. They've done some research, and they said that soccer has been played, although they didn't say soccer, they said football has been played in the region, the MacArthur region, since 1947. And a good friend of ours.
Good friend of mine.
A good friend of Paul's. And he's now a good friend of mine too.
On Twitter.
On Twitter.
But maybe if you came to a South game, you could actually meet him more formally and discuss these things with him.
What's this South game you talk about?
Oh, there's this great club called South Melbourne. Okay. It's very niche. It's cult. It's,
yeah. Well, I should go because I'd get in for free as well.
Because you've got a membership.
Yeah. What was his name?
DJ El Raffo.
DJ El Raffo. He heard this claim and he said, surely, Ian, you can find that's not the case. And so he set me a task. He set me a challenge. So I studied and worked and sought and looked. And 3 minutes later, I came back from Trove with the evidence to demolish the 1947 argument.
3 minutes?
3 minutes.
What took you so long?
I know. I had a coffee in between time. So it was a bit disappointing to find it so easily. And some of the dates I found was there's a game in 1931, which is 16 years before the claim date, of a public school.
Can we just talk about what is the MacArthur region? Because, you know, maybe some of us are from Victoria and we're Victorian exceptionalists and we don't know what's going on up there.
I think MacArthur tends to be in, it's Campbelltown, Camden, Picton. It's west of Sydney and it extends towards the southwest, towards places like Bowral, towards places like, or on the way to Canberra, I guess. But, you know, stops short of the Southern Highlands. So it's like it's a grassy plain where...
It's pastoral?
Pastoral, yeah, but it's become developed now. And so it actually does make sense as a region.
Okay.
And it's and I think it's kind of, if it's appropriate to have football teams anywhere, it's appropriate to have a team there to represent that region in some way. But I don't want to talk too much about that. So in Picton was one of the towns, a more southern town in the region. There was a game of soccer played in 1931 at the school. Now, that all it has to be is a game of soccer to contradict the claim, doesn't it? It doesn't,
yes.
It doesn't have to be senior soccer or anything like that.
No.
And then I found this one from 1924 in the St. George Call, which is published in Cogra. And I'll read out a little bit of it because it's quite a nice image that it describes. Last year, we frequently read of the expansion of the code that is soccer in the country districts throughout the state. And driving through the Camden district this last 2 weeks, I've seen evidence of this. Noticing soccer goalposts erected in one or two isolated places, my curiosity was naturally aroused. And from inquiries, I learnt that an attempt was made to form an association last season. So in 1923... an attempt had been made to form an association which included a team from Camden. Mm. Now, that strikes me as soccer in MacArthur.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, obviously, there's no malice involved in making this mistake. It's just a mistake that they've made. Why do you think they've made it?
Because they're careless. Because they make assumptions about, you know, they find the first thing, they don't know where to look.
Yeah.
Maybe they've asked somebody who they think maybe knows the answer. I'm not sure.
They've maybe gone to a club website, and just 90% of club websites in Australia actually don't know the history of the club.
No.
That's probably too positive. Probably 95% don't know the history and don't know these starting dates. And the argument might be made there's no point trying to find a starting date because you can always find a time before. But what is the 1947 figure likely to be then?
Maybe a British hostile team. But then again, why are they out there so early, I suppose? I mean, they're usually on the coast somewhere because that's where they've arrived.
Yeah, I think it's possibly the formation of an association. I need to do more research. I was just rising to Dr. El Raffo's challenge.
He's no doctor.
Oh, well, let's call him that. He'll be pleased. Is he listening? I hope he's listening. Mm-hmm. I was rising to his challenge, and it did not take me very long at all. I actually found some red herrings, and I made some mistakes. I found a game in Picton in 1921, but that was the Picton Reserve in Broken Hill. So, oops. So I made a couple of mistakes, but I still definitely found a substantial number of games played before 1947.
And that's all that matters.
Yeah, that's all that matters. And I think it's a lesson for all of us. It's a lesson about assumptions that we make when we think about the history that we know. Because often there is a time before, and I mean the great claim that's wrong in Australian soccer history is that the game first played in 1880, And I think we have, a number of us have disrupted that myth. Why are you smiling?
Oh, because I know you love the 1880 number and the New South Wales exception list to maintain that number. And it's like, well.
Yeah. When we know that it was, you know, any number of games of soccer-ish were played. There was a game of soccer-ish in Melbourne in 1858.
Yes.
But that's a game that's been claimed by...
somebody else.
By somebody else who will remain nameless.
For now.
For now. All right, so that's what I did last week. I researched the history that wasn't there, but then found a really interesting one just nearby. And then I got slightly irritated and prompted by a claim made on behalf of the newest A-League franchise.
And while everyone else was complaining about the logo and all that kind of stuff, you were like, well, that date's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like the logo, to be honest. It's,
I couldn't care less.
Yeah, but I mean, this is going to get me unfollowed by any number of people, but I kind of agreed with that woman's argument that the Bulls are a strange name when you're trying to have an equal opportunity club.
Well, one can be the Bulls and one can be the Heifers. I don't know.
Well, the Heifers. my suggestion was call them the Beasts.
The Beasts.
Well, that's a great name for a team, isn't it? The Beasts.
Oh, let's go to a break.
Yeah, we'll go to a break. If you know your history,
then you would know where you're coming from. You're listening to If You Know Your History, and in brackets, and even if you do, what's the point, on FNR Radio, FNR Football Nation Radio with
What's N-size. The point?
Well... that's something you've got to figure out along the way, isn't it? Isn't that part of the journey?
It is, it is.
I mean, even if you're only playing devil's advocate,
you
still have to ask, what is the point of this?
Yeah.
Right? That's the fundamental question as well. It's not just if you know your history. Okay, you know stuff, fantastic.
Yeah.
But then what?
Then we know where we're coming from.
And then what?
And then we know where we're going.
And then we can correct people and they can change something on the website.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's move on.
Yeah. To...
well, we're going to do 100 years ago today.
Okay.
And the last show I had, all these 100 years ago todays prepared, and I didn't get to do any of it because we had too much interesting communication.
So you're going to do 100 years ago today and last week?
No, I'm going to do it from today, from the 23rd of May 1919.
Well, apologies to the week before then.
Yeah, sorry, the week before. And I was going to talk about the Spanish flu and people dying and death rates and stuff
which is topical.
Yeah, they still apply. I mean, at this stage in Australian history, at one phase, maybe in towards June, 1,000 people a week were dying from the flu epidemic, and it killed around 15,000 people in Australia.
And some of them probably played soccer.
Yeah, and it disrupted sport in a massive way. So that was an interesting moment. But I'm found a few interesting pieces. One from Sydney, one from Tasmania, and one from Melbourne. And the first one comes from The Propeller, which is published in the St. George District. And I imagine it's called The Propeller because that's like a plane reference.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Unless the thing, the whole notion is about propelling objects.
Well, possibly, but it's, I don't know. I tried to find out briefly, but I didn't try all that hard. So it remains a guess. But this is soccer football by penalty, so we're calling it soccer football. Which is like, when you think about it, it's like calling it association football.
Yes.
Isn't it? Yeah. So it's a problem. By penalty. On Saturday last at Penshurst Park, Hurstville defeated Croydon in the senior grade of the Rechabite competition by 2-1. The Rechabites.
Who are the Rechabites?
The Rechabites are off to Wikipedia. The Rechabites are... the Rechabites are a... historically, they're a biblical clan, the descendants of Rechab through Jehonadab.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah.
So there's a whole story, but in the modern history, the Rechabites refers to a religious order similar in some of the ways to the Nazarites. In more recent times, the name has been used by Christian groups keen to promote total abstinence from alcohol, such as the Independent Order of Rechabites.
And we should remember and we should inform the audience here, but they're not familiar with these kinds of things. The teetotaling movements were very important in Australia in the early, in the late 1800s and certainly in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
You think of Australia as a nation covered in drink, and it was.
Yep.
But equally, there were people who were deadly opposed to that, and often they were, more often than not, they're from religious groups.
And you also have to realise that the Protestantism that is that the Rechabites are part of, is also a big part in Australian soccer, especially in New South Wales.
Is that is that so?
Yeah, it is, and we'll talk about that, I guess, in a moment. Okay, for the winners, Coates scored with a shot from the wing and Miller from a penalty kick. A special remark must be made on the player, the skipper, Goalie Dudley, whose splendid saves drew much applause from the crowd of onlookers. The junior match was postponed on account of Carlton being unable to secure a team. The Cogra Magpies were given a hint in a local contemporary last week not to let Balmain repeat the doze which they gave Hurstville the week before, 5-0. Notwithstanding the warning, Balmain did repeat the dose with a little to spare, beating the Magpies by 6-0. Sunday's matches are Hurstville A versus Cogra at Ramsgate and Hurstville B versus Marrickville at Penshurst Park at 3 p.m. So this is an enclosed competition, the Rechabite League, and it's centred in the St George district, and so I did a bit of research on this and I found reference to some of these teams in Phil Moseley's amazingly important book, Soccer in New South Wales, 1880 to 1980. It's the most thorough history of any state in Australian football history or soccer history. And, you know, I would love to be able to produce a book like that for Victoria. And one could be done. It'd probably be even more interesting than this because
it's... Because it's about Victoria.
Yeah. Yeah, or something like that. But what's interesting about there's a chapter here called Protestants, Catholics and Football. And he means football in terms of across codes. And he says, Phil Moseley, from the 1910s, football in Sydney was characterised by a religious polarisation. Working class Protestants gravitated to soccer and working class Catholics to rugby league. Church officials never pronounced in favour of any game, but given the size and success of Protestant churches soccer in Sydney as well as Newcastle, combined with the almost complete involvement of Catholic schools in rugby league, a clear division was glaringly obvious. So that's a really... I'd read this before, but it was only sort of correlating this stuff with what I read in the paper from 100 years ago today. It made me realise the sort of importance of this argument. And so we've talked about all sorts of things in relation to why did soccer rise? Why did it not dominate? Why did it dominate here? Why did it not dominate here? What happened in Victoria? Why is it so weak in Victoria? And I think we often forget to think about that religious aspect.
Because we're a much more secular society now.
Yeah.
I mean, even people who say their children to religious schools are not perhaps particularly religious themselves.
Yeah.
There's other sort of values that they ascribe to those schools, for example. So why would certain religions take up soccer and others not? I mean, what happens there?
I'm not sure. I mean, it could... Yeah, I don't know. There's a very strong Scottish influence in soccer, and a lot of the people that come from Scotland, I guess, would tend to be Presbyterian.
And so, therefore, a lot of these very small religious sects, Protestant sects, would come from Scotland, and perhaps the north of England, sort of low Anglican, you would say.
Well, or Methodist. I mean, Methodist, where I'm from, in a mining village in Durham, that's very strong Wesleyan. History there.
So there's sort of these unaffiliated kind of Protestant groups, which tend to come up from away from the southern sort of Anglican traditions, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. And they bring soccer with them as well as their religion and as well as their values.
Yep. And so, and as I said before, Paul, sometimes we say, oh, well, they were minors, that's why they played soccer. But actually some minors played rugby league.
Yes.
And the fact might be that they were minors and they were Wesleyans or they were Methodists. That's why they played soccer.
Well, certainly there were Presbyterian teams in Melbourne and so forth. Yep. And, I mean, there would have been church teams and teams based on religious sects,
yeah,
and churches competitions. It'd be interesting to see across the country how religion plays a part. Well, and I think it's been really undervalued. Yeah.
I raised this with Twitter before, and Gary McKenzie responded. He said he could only think of three religious teams.
Self-evidently religious.
Yes, yeah, evidently religious. And that's kind of interesting, and maybe Queensland did develop in that way. But you've got to also understand the point that maybe this team in Howard of miners were also Wesleyans. And it's, you know, we might focus on the fact that they're miners because that's what they did. That's why they were there. But the fact that they were Wesleyans might well have contributed to that. And maybe the Catholics in Howard played rugby or rugby league.
Mm.
It's, you know, there's obviously more work needs to be done.
And I mean, we're looking, I mean, we want to bring in the buzz, you know, kind of word of in your academia at the moment, which is intersectionality. We have to look at all the factors involved with a person's identity. So if you're looking at a person's religion, you're looking at a person's occupation, but, you know, it's a class situation as well because there would have been sort of, you know, Wesleyans and Methodists in Sydney who established, like, the grammar schools and so forth.
Yeah.
And they had pretty much no interest in soccer.
Yeah.
So therefore, the Rechabites and the other small Protestant denominations playing soccer in Sydney perhaps are because of a lower class situation or maybe lower middle class.
Mm.
And therefore, they're sort of set apart from some of their perhaps Methodist or Wesleyan brethren in that way.
Well, I mean, you look at Scotch College here, for example. Now, there's a Presbyterian Scottish school. Well, what sport comes out of Presbyterian Scotland? Soccer, but not into Scotch College.
No.
Scotch College doesn't start with soccer until the 1970s. And one of Melbourne's great soccer players, Goodson, in the very early days, not the very early days, in the 1910s, he was a master at Scotch College and obviously didn't get to play or coach the game there, and he went and played for Thistles.
And then you come into a situation where, because of Australian rules, perhaps in Melbourne and to a certain extent in later on in Adelaide and Perth, just takes over so much that, you know, there's no real space for other sports and other, and even whatever the religion you are, whatever the job you do, you just end up playing Australian rules as an example.
Yeah.
Because of its, but in Sydney, rugby league and rugby union don't seem to perhaps take over.
No.
In that kind of
way. There's no global game. There's no universal game.
No.
In Sydney, but the divisions are often on religious grounds, whereas in Melbourne, there are religious differences in sport, but that's between Melbourne and Collingwood.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even then, it's sort of like a loose thing because there's just as many Methodists involved with Collingwood as well.
Yeah.
That's one of the interesting things you sort of read. I mean, Collingwood Football Club is an association with Catholicism, but there's, you know, people who look at it more objectively say, well, there's just as many Methodists and so forth around. Because people were affiliated, officially or unofficially, to a religious sect at the time. And it depends on the particular environment that they're in, which sport they're going to be closely attached to. Yeah. And if you're in Melbourne and, you know, it's commercial kind of culture and it's social culture, I mean, footy just takes over straight away.
Yeah.
Whereas in Sydney, perhaps because of the layout of the geography as well, where people are more isolated because of the hilly kind of geography, perhaps it's easier for soccer and for rugby league and for them to eke out their own little territories.
Yeah.
And perhaps, I mean, we've got to look at these things on class, on occupation, on religion and geography as well. Yeah. I think it's really complicated then.
Yep.
But that's almost the way you've got to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, religion still plays a role long after this. I mean, in Australian soccer, but in a different way because it's linked to distinct ethnic communities. Obviously, Jewish soccer in Australia is heavily, I mean, the Jewish question is always, are they ethnicity, are they a religion?
Yeah.
And then it's always the answer is, they're both.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about, in, say, the late 1800s, early 1900s, about muscular Christianity.
Mm.
And one of the things that Jewish athletes took at the time was muscular Judaism.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was because of Zionism. The ideology of Zionism said, if you're going to defend the promised land, if you're going to defend Israel or Palestine, you have to be able to do it, you know, with your strength. And so they pursued athletic kind of ideals. And that's not much different to the Christian groups that would have done similar kinds of things. I mean, the more you played a lot of these Rechabites and Protestants would have said, play sport to keep you away from temptation like women and drink, which must seem like a really naff kind of thing to think now when, you know, you play sport to get more drink and more girls.
But speak for yourself.
Well, sure. Yeah. What did you play sport for?
The glory.
The glory of the game.
Yeah.
You're a true,
No, okay. Okay, well, look, I've got three things to talk about. That was the first aspect, religion, and I think it's something that we haven't really focused on much, and maybe it's something in down the track we need to keep coming back to a little, because it's
keep it in mind.
Yeah, it's a dimension that we need to focus on.
I mean, even the just as an aside, I mean, that's when everyone knows Johnny Warren's story about, you know, getting sent home to eat more porridge because he was too small for the team he played for.
Yeah,
that was a church team.
Yeah,
I think the local priest was the coach of the team, the under 12s. So, I mean, this is into the 1970s, 1960s, 50s. I mean, so the influence is there persistently. Yeah. And there's still churches competitions out there, and they're still going quite very strongly. And even a few weeks ago, we talked about the German Templars who founded Knox. I mean, these things persist ongoing, I think.
Well, the next article I found was in a newspaper called World from Tasmania. I think it's from Hobart. And remember, we're just the war's finished. We're starting the new season after the war, and this is about reviving. This is called reviving the game. Soccer, like most other games, has been in abeyance for the last 4 years. But the Junior Association continued playing till the season before last. But after that, with a large number of players enlisting or leaving here for other places, and the absences of the late JJB Honeysett in England, people who complain about writers today have this idea that people always used to write perfect sentences. And there's a perfect example of the way the lead sentence in a newspaper article just doesn't make any sense because it's ridiculously long. Anyway.
You didn't learn about the inverted triangles.
No. The game died down altogether. Sorry. But this year, I think I've even mucked myself up there. The game died down altogether, but this year a determined effort has been made by a few of the old association to revive the game, at least in the junior division, and it certainly seems as if their efforts are to be rewarded. Several meetings and so on and so forth. So here the game's declined, but the thing I wanted to focus on there was JJB Honeysett, who's a kind of a giant of a figure in Tasmanian soccer. And I looked up, I got Paul Hunt to inform me when he died, and so Paul gave me a link about Honeysett's death. And I didn't realise, I actually hadn't realised that he died during the war. News has been received of the death in London on May 9 of Joseph J.B. Honeysett, a well-known resident of Hobart. Mr. Honeysett, who was for many years an officer in the Imperial Post Office, retired in 1904 and came to Tasmania in search of health. His long service in the Post Office was recognised by His Majesty the King by the grant of the Imperial Service Order. I wonder what religion he was. Mr. Honeysett, who suffered a paralytic stroke in 1914 soon after the death of his wife, partially recovered and last year went home with the hope of obtaining a complete recovery. He succumbed to another stroke when his hopes seemed to be on the point of being realised. His son, Lieutenant Honeysett, was recently wounded and taken prisoner at Bullecourt. The deceased was keenly interested in British Association football, soccer, and by his enthusiasm started and built up the interest in the game in Tasmania. He is rightly regarded as the father of the game. Mr. Honeysett was a capable and enthusiastic musician, and so on and so on. So he has all these other aspects. He's a sort of all-round kind of guy, and very capable. But he almost like force of personality. He's this dominant figure. He's the Doherty from Victoria, and so on. He's the figure who leads the game. And when he goes away and dies, it's almost like the wind gets taken, as well as the war. The wind gets taken out.
Because soccer depends on these people in the early days.
It does, And, you know, to some extent it still does. Is that right?
Well, the same way people put all their hopes and dreams into Frank Lowy, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. And it was seen to be him, or he and O'Neill. What was his name?
John.
John, was he? Yeah, John O'Neill. They were going to be leaders that took us away from the wilderness into this brave new world of whatever it is we're in right now.
I'm fine. That's okay with me.
Yeah. So I just wanted to draw people's attention to this chap. I mean, and also to the game reviving. So all around Australia, we've got the game reviving. It's the first season after the war. But each one has different issues that are important to them. And, Tasmania are trying to rebuild, whereas Sydney is not trying to rebuild. Sydney has just hit the ground running and has taken off like wildfire. Which, speaking of not hitting the ground running, let's move to Melbourne, The Age. On the same day, on this day 100 years ago, The Age reported, British Association, the following matches under soccer rules will be played at Middle Park tomorrow. Footscray Thistle versus Spotswood, the referee is George Hawes, and St David's are playing Melbourne Thistle with the referee is H. Butler. Kick-off at 3 p.m. And then a special meeting of the association will be held at the Amateur Sports Club on Monday next at 8 p.m. and all members are requested to attend. So this, we've talked about this before, this kind of enthusiastic amateur kind of feel to Melbourne soccer at this stage after the war. I mean, you still don't have a lot of the players. Remember soccer's had been growing before the war, but you still don't have the players back. You still don't have the good players back. You don't have Northumberland and Durham's, for example, who are really top team at this point. And so you've got, Melbourne. What are we going to do with Melbourne?
They're not sure.
Yeah.
It's all a bit... Yeah, iffy, and it's sort of history repeating itself because they've been in this situation a few times already.
So the point of reading three out today was to give you a sense of what's the different aspects and the different parts. So I could have looked at South Australia, I could have looked at Western Australia, but I'm trying each time I do this to cover Australia, and I'd love to get Darwin. I think Darwin, there'll be stuff in Darwin very soon that I can talk about. So that'll be good as well.
Excellent. Yeah. Shall we go to a break?
Yeah, we will.
You're listening to If You Know Your History on Football Nation Radio, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
This is Football Nation Radio, and you're listening to If You Know Your History with Ian Sison and Paul Mavroudis. And Paul, you've been reading stuff.
Oh, it's been a while since I've read anything. Good. And yeah, back on the bandwagon of reading things.
And how do you feel about that?
I actually felt good.
You're home. Have you come home?
Yeah. What a relief. I can still do this. It's nice.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we went to talk about this last year when we did the original six episodes.
That famous six episodes.
What a great time that was. It was so long ago. Was this book, Playing for Australia by Trevor Thompson. It's the Playing for Australia, the First Socceroos, Asia and World Football. And I finally finished it yesterday and took my notes, and actually was kind of really impressed by this. So I'm really happy to have finished reading this and to be able to talk about it today.
He's an impressive guy too, Trevor. I heard him speak at the Football Writers Festival and he was really quite good.
Is he a better speaker than a writer perhaps? Is that being unkind about that?
Can I take the fifth?
Yeah.
No. He's a good speaker. I think he's a decent writer as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
He might be watching.
I hope so. Now, Trevor Thompson's not his first football book.
No.
He's previously written One Fantastic Goal, which was one of a slew of books that came out during the time the Socceroos had made the 2006 World Cup.
Yeah.
You had a conspiracy theory about that.
In that review that I wrote?
No, just in general. Did you write a review of this one, of that book?
I reviewed a whole heap of books around the World Cup, including Matthew Hall's reissued away game where it was clearly reorganised so that the contemporary Socceroos were front and centre.
So it wasn't necessarily the authors who were trying to latch onto the thing. It was actually the publishing houses who were trying to
publishing
make...
Publishing houses, yeah. And they were mistaken. They were mistaken. They were deluded that, soccer books would make them rich.
Did it?
No.
No, that's a shame. I must admit, I wasn't a huge fan of One Fantastic Goal. I thought it was a bit of a cash-in. I mean, not from necessarily from Trevor's point of view, but from... It felt a bit underwritten.
It wasn't finished.
No.
Yeah.
It felt a bit underdone.
Yeah.
The parts that repeated themselves.
Yeah.
And I think if he had more time and a more forgiving environment where he wasn't rushed to write it for the World Cup.
Perhaps like this.
It would have been a better job and a bit more interesting. But I'm glad to say I enjoy this a lot more. Yeah. And I thought this is a much more complete book and I think probably truer to what Trevor wanted to finish the book as.
Yeah.
With, you know, obviously working for Bonita Mercyatis, his Fair Play Publishing, there's more freedom.
Yeah.
It's not an economic concern, perhaps.
Yeah.
Playing for Australia, as we noted, came out late last year via Bonita Mercyatis, Fair Play Publishing. Its main focus is in the early days of the Australian national team, long before they were called the Socceroos and long before they were entering international competitions. So we're talking from about 1922 to the early 1940s. So we have a very much an interwar kind of aspect here. There is some material which precedes that, which talks about New South Wales representative teams playing against New Zealand like 1902, thereabouts.
1905, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like
that. James Huthersall has the view that that's the first time that Australian played internationally. What does he think about that?
Well, I'm not sure he has a definitive answer to that, but what does come up frequently is that New South Wales is by far the strongest soccer state, and it is the case for at least the first 50 years of that of the 20th century. And the only state that comes even close is Queensland, realistically.
Yep.
So Queensland produces players which are capable of playing in the national team on their own merits.
Yep.
But there's this constant idea, and it's probably justified in most cases, that New South Wales is so far and away the best team, that to include players from any other state, even from Queensland, is to actually sell the team short in terms of its capabilities. And the tension between the states is a key part of the early national team history, because when the Australian national team plays some of its games in Melbourne or in Adelaide, it by tradition almost, or almost by economic necessity, plays South Australian and Victorian players. And yet there's widespread acknowledgement that these players are not the best players that Australia can field.
Yeah.
I mean, they might be good enough to field for most of the games that against the opposition they're playing against, but they're really not the best of the best.
But, I mean, there's a different ideology at play too, isn't it? It's about giving everyone a go, giving teams, states representation. It's not necessarily about producing the absolute best team. It's about producing a representative team.
Yes, but this is just one of the tensions in Australian soccer at the time. And I mean, there are state-based tensions. There are regional-based tensions between, say, the Hunter and the Illawarra and Sydney.
Yep.
There are club versus national team and national federation interests. There are clubs who are almost point blank refuse to send their players there to the national team. There's splits. There's arguments about amateurism and professionalism, which are really odd because if you're asking players to go overseas and say to Dutch East Indies and Singapore and so forth, I mean, that's a long time. That's like a month away, and you've got to pay these players at least some broken time payments.
Yep.
But these players were seen as splitters, by the National Federation, I think it is, where, they're desecrating the amateur spirit. And because Australia is affiliated with the FA, the Football Association in England, rather than with the newly formed FIFA, and they still have the amateur kind of ethos. And this really hurts Australian soccer because on the one hand, they're trying to be this very amateur kind of team, principles. But on the other hand, the only games they play are based on private enterprise almost. Either the federation is putting up money for a team to come visit, or just as likely, an individual is funding a team from China or from India or from Czechoslovakia to come here and play the game. And they want money back. They're guaranteeing the success or the loss of money. Mm. And even the FA actually has problems with this as well, because the FA says, well, we don't want to enrich private individuals, which is, that's the only way anybody's actually going to come out to Australia, is they can guarantee them like income and safety and, food.
So what's the difference then between the way soccer fails and it's in a much richer context, much more potential international play? Why does soccer fail in this regard when rugby and rugby league succeed?
I don't really know. I'm not sure that. I'm not sure Thompson has the answer to that. I'm not sure he really covers the other sports in any particular depth, or in any real meaningful kind of sense. But certainly, in New South Wales, they're trying to get a semi-professional state league going up in the 1920s. That fails for all sorts of reasons. But where the game has some sort of money, I suppose, and some drive in the 1920s, by the 1930s, the National Association is broke. And most of the state federations are not doing too well. And most of the strength lies in club teams, like your Metas in Sydney and teams like that, where they can afford to maybe pay some of the players and actually control what's going on in the game. One of the interesting things that Thompson does actually is he does little chapters on some of the other countries around the region.
Mm.
And so he looks at the case of Japan, he looks at the case of India, Philippines and Dutch East Indies, China and New Zealand.
Mm.
And in terms of at least the approach to international competition, Thompson's argument is that Japan, China, Dutch East Indies, partly because of the relationships of their own colonial masters or their own colonial kind of sphere of influence, have much more support from the FA to play international competition.
Mm.
So the Dutch East Indies go to obviously the World Cup in 1938. I think it's either China or Japan attempt to go to the world to the Olympics in 1936. I think Japan makes it there. They qualify, mm-hmm. I think it is. They're more open minded because the Dutch East Indies have a relationship with the Netherlands, and the Netherlands are much more supportive of the Dutch East Indies as a colonial kind of outpost of soccer and culture in general than the British are.
So Australia was hogtied by its loyalty to a master that didn't give a shit about it.
No.
Sorry about that.
That's exactly right. The British FA, all they do is they send a couple of teams out, one in 1925 or 27, thereabouts.
25.
Yeah, which is just like a disaster of a tour. I mean, in terms of the Australians are not competitive.
Yeah. The 5-0, the game in Melbourne.
I mean, and throughout the whole tour, it's just a joke. And there's a lot of ill feeling between the players as well and the tourists. Mm. And then there's another tour of the English amateur team in 1937, when Australia is much more competitive.
Yeah.
And then kind of figure out where Australia's level is. It's sort of the second tier of nations.
Yeah.
But even though Australia becomes to realise, the Australian football bodies come to realise that there's no support from the English and the British, they still prefer to be under that yoke.
Yeah.
And there's a moment in here where they're compared to their membership of the FA is a sort of subsidiary level of no meaning.
Yeah.
They're on the same level as the Elementary Schools Association
as a
member of the Football Association.
Yeah.
It's nothing. And they could have been a member of FIFA and they chose not to do that, rather be a subsidiary.
Yeah.
There's another moment where Roy Drury talks about melting down the trophy that was given for the interstate competition by the English.
That's the one in FFE at the moment.
Correct.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, it's just sitting there. It's just litter. It cost me £1 a year, whatever it is, to insure it. We might as well just melt it down and distribute the proceeds to the states.
Because that'd be, by the stage you're talking about, that'd probably be worth £1,000.
Well, early 1930s, I mean, interstate competition never really took off.
Mm.
And again, that's partly because New South Wales, again, was so dominant, and Victoria in particular was so weak. Mm. And that's really strange because you have these details like, you know, the VFL Second 18's secretary saying there's this menace of soccer and, you know, they're going to come and get us and all this kind of thing. It's like, this is 1933, soccer in Victoria is at a low ebb.
There were the right times to make these arguments and the wrong times. I think 1955 was the right time to make the argument, or the mid-60s was the right time to make that argument, but I don't think the 30s was the right time.
No, but it's just really strange. Yeah.
Well, that's when you've got that mad stuff in the footy record.
With George Cathy.
Yeah, George Cathy stuff about seeing a game in England.
The book has some great stuff about the various tours, about the motivations, about how they went about. How New Zealand soccer held us back because it was so weak in its own right. The pettiness of the interstate rivalries as well. I mean, New South Wales just hated the Queenslanders so much, you can probably relate.
Yeah.
Even when Queensland players were good enough to play for Australia, there would be teams just made up completely of New South Welshmen.
Yeah.
I think if there's one drawback from this book, it's the lack of a reference list.
Okay.
And I think that's something that, going forward, I think that people writing these kinds of books should really include. Mm. It doesn't really cost much more. I mean, you've already done the research.
Yeah.
And I mean, people might want to chase things up. I mean, you might find details in there and you'd want to look it up.
Well, you'd be a bibliographic service for hire, wouldn't you, Paul, if people are wanting to...
Yeah, absolutely. But what I'll tell you the thing that I like the most about this book, and overall I really did enjoy it, I do recommend the purchase of it, is the little details. Little things that he's picked up somewhere along the line and, you know, which give a lot of colour and sort of idea of what's going on. And one of my favourite thing, I think, is the war cry that the Australians had when they were in the Dutch East Indies. And he goes here, war cries had been in vogue in Australia and seemed to have taken root after the haka of the New Zealand rugby team was performed in Australia in 1903. The folksy Australian chant can't claim any status other than a curiosity invented for this tour. Dutch language newspapers report the song went as follows. Ego ya, the emu, the wallaby, the kangaroo, the wombat. Who are we? We are the boys from the southern sea. Bonzo Comba, Dinky Dye, best of luck to you and I. Will not fail a young Australia. Ego ya, Bosca. Now, that wasn't quite invented for that tour because I've actually found references to similar chants earlier on in Trove.
On that note.
So, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah.
I mean, do buy the book. Do support it. It's a really interesting book.
Also support another book that's just been published by, I keep forgetting the name. What's the name of the publishing company?
Fair Play Publishing.
Fair Play Publishing. Sorry, Benita. Fair Play Publishing have just published the Encyclopedia of the Matildas.
Yeah. So keep, you know, support the people that are doing the right thing.
Get to that website.
Absolutely. And we'll see you next week because the Preston people are outside again.
Yes, and send us tweets. Tell us what you wanted to hear us talk about because we're guns for hire, okay? See you next week.
See you next week.